Good afternoon, Chief Justice Steele. May it please the court, William Fletcher on behalf of the appellants Tina and Ashley Atwell. This appeal involves a dispute arising from the Atwells' purchase of their first home that occurred back in December of 2000. The matter had been through a lengthy litigation, and the appeal deals with decisions of the lower court that denied the plaintiff a new trial, and also a decision that entered summary judgment in favor of the homeowners insurance policy issuer, Lititz Insurance Company, in May of 2005. Regarding the claim against RHIS, which was tried for a second time in the year 2007, the main issues that are raised on appeal deal with two aspects of the trial, one being the defendants presenting to the jury information regarding a settlement of a co-defendant, and also the effect of that on the evidence in a case where there was significant and, from our perspective, undeniable evidence that RHIS had failed to perform in an appropriate manner in doing a home inspection of this property. This case was settled between the plaintiff and a co-defendant, Davis, before the trial in 2007 ever occurred. As a result of that settlement, the case that was scheduled to go forward in 2007 was the plaintiff, Atwells, versus RHIS, who in turn had a claim over against Mr. Davis, a claim for contribution where RHIS was contending that if they were liable, then Davis was also liable in part or in whole for the plaintiff's damages. This was not a complex situation where there was a need to for the court to realign parties so that the jury would not be confused. This was not a case where the jury was actually going to hear about two accidents in which injuries were caused by different aspects of those accidents.
Counsel,
yes, Your Honor.
I'm somewhat confused about the argument being made here. Is the argument that it was error to present any evidence at all of any kind of the settlement, or is the argument that the particular use that was made of that evidence was improper?
Your Honor, in this case, we take the position that it's both. In other words, the defendant should not have been permitted to bring up before the jury the issue of a settlement. I believe in earlier decisions of this court in Wright versus Moore.
It was error to tell the jury that there was a settlement at all. Yes?
No, Your Honor. There may be an occasion, as was stated in the Wright case, where the judge would tell the jury that a party is no longer in the case and that they need not speculate as to why. But even that limited comment does not inform the jury that there's been a settlement.
Are you saying that it was an error to inform the jury that there was a settlement?
Yes, Your Honor. And that was compounded by the fact that of the information that was given to the jury by the defense in their opening and closing statements regarding that settlement.
This was an issue that all the parties knew might come up before trial, isn't it?
I believe so, Your Honor. The settlement happened in spring or summer of 07. The trial was in September.
Was there any effort to resolve how it would be handled in a pretrial stipulation or by pretrial application to the court?
There was, Your Honor. There was a pretrial application by the plaintiff during an office conference before the trial ever started, where the plaintiff requested that the defendant not be permitted to raise the issue of settlement with Davis in any respect throughout the course of the trial.
Was that resolved?
Well, the lower court, Your Honor, initially indicated that the only issue in the case, that the plaintiff's issue in the case was his claim against RHIS. However, before the trial began, the court ruled that it was going to use the very same language that was used in the Wright case to inform the jury that Davis is no longer a party defendant and that they need not speculate. And that was all that the court said about it, Your Honor.
Well, but did the court or the parties agree that there were limitations on what counsel could or should say and limit anything that the jury heard to simply what the court told them?
We presented a motion, Your Honor, of record that that the defendant should not be permitted to discuss the settlement.
Now, I understand you made your application. I want to know how the court resolved it.
The court resolved it by ruling that it was going to make the statement that it did that I just mentioned to you, but then also resolved it by allowing the defendant to address the jury and tell the jury that there was a settlement and that he would be permitted to do that in his opening statement.
And that was over your objection?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. Now, what exactly was said by counsel in opening or closing that you contend was reversible error?
Your Honor, specifically, the defendant in their opening statement made the following statements with a PowerPoint presentation that had the caption, the original caption of the case in front of the jury. The defendant comes forward and says that the plaintiffs have filed this complaint against both of these defendants. And then through me, I filed a cross claim against Mr. Davis. And we're essentially saying we did nothing wrong. He then goes on and says that essentially at this point, since Mr. Davis has settled, you are not going to hear this part of the plaintiff's case. He being a plaintiff's counsel, has no incentive now to prove to you that Mr. Davis was at fault. That was stated in the opening, Your Honor. And in closing, the defense counsel stated again regarding Mr. Davis that you may recall the testimony of Mr. Davis. He essentially came in and fell on the sword. I mean, he's a nice fellow. He has settled out. He doesn't have a worry now in this case. He's not in jeopardy. He essentially fell on the sword. We contend, Your Honor, that those types of comments are attempts by the defense to either show that the claim against them is weak or invalid, or that the real party at fault is Mr. Davis, who settled, and that's why he settled. And to contend that he has settled and he doesn't have to worry now, he's not in jeopardy, seems to suggest that he had no basis to come into court. He didn't have to worry about anything because he settled his case.
Did you object at the time of the closing statement?
Your Honor, we filed our motion. No, and if I can explain. We filed our motion or presented our motion at this pretrial conference. And then, before openings, we renewed the motion that no mention of settlement be made. And then, during the opening statement, we even interrupted opening statement to again challenge the information that the defendant wanted to present to the jury about the settlement. And on all of those occasions, we were ruled against. And so at that point, Your Honor, we felt the law of the case was that the defendant was going to be allowed to talk about settlement. And so there wasn't really anything more for us to object to. We thought the matter had been resolved.
In terms of the way in which this finally went to trial and all the paperwork that the jury would have seen, was there a feasible way in which this could have been tried without ever mentioning a lawsuit against Davis?
Without ever mentioning the plaintiff's lawsuit against Davis,
right.
Yes, Your Honor. I believe it could have been.
Okay, but you've qualified your answer. I assume you are doing that because RHIS was making a cross-claim against Davis. And,
yes.
And that was still in the trial, was it?
There was still a claim for contribution by RHIS against Davis. Yes, Your Honor.
So regardless of whether you had ever sued Davis, that cross-claim would still be viable, right?
Yes.
And that was presented to the jury, and the jury rejected it. Well, I guess they found no liability, so.
That raises an interesting aspect of what was transpiring, Your Honor, in that, yes, there was. The way I see this, Your Honor, is that by the time that the settlement had occurred, what you basically had was plaintiff's claim against RHIS, and then RHIS defending that claim, but also asserting that another party shares some responsibility, almost a third-party claim in a sense. And
was that tried to the – I mean, was evidence presented to the jury that, you know, to the extent that you think we're liable, bear in mind that Davis did these various things that would make him a contributor to the liability or partially liable?
Yes, Your Honor. The defendant, RHIS, called Mr. Davis to establish their claim against him. And what the jury did, though, Your Honor, was – And during its deliberations, its last question to the court was, why are we being asked to decide any liability by Mr. Davis since he's already settled? And I raise that only to indicate to the court the impact of what happens when a jury is told that there's been a settlement.
But what was the answer to that question? How was the jury instructed in response to that question?
I believe they were instructed, Your Honor, that if they find that RHIS was not liable, then they need not be concerned with Davis. I think that's how it was answered, Your Honor.
But what if they found that RHIS was liable? What were they supposed to do then?
They would then.
What were they told to what they were supposed to do?
Under the instructions, they were told that they would then consider whether Davis committed any wrongdoing, and then allocate. Or a portion of fault between the two of them.
Okay, but what I'm hearing, and I'm probably missing something here, is that the jury's question really wasn't answered because the jury was saying, you know, why are we bothering with Davis since Davis has already settled? And the court said, well, if you don't find liability against RHIS, then you don't have to worry about Davis. If you do find liability against RHIS, then you've got to decide how much of it is Davis's responsibility, but I don't hear that there was ever an answer that said, and it doesn't matter that there's already been a settlement because those things are going to be apportioned notwithstanding the settlement or something like that.
There was no statement to that effect, Your Honor, that I recall made by the court to the jury in response to that question that dealt with the issue of the settlement itself.
And I take it that you did not object to the way the court said it was going to handle this question?
I did not, Your Honor. But in looking at the at what was said here and looking at Rule 408, it seems clear that there was a purposeful attempt to bring forth the settlement to show that someone else was liable. It wasn't to show a realignment of parties. It wasn't to avoid jury confusion. In fact, the jury became more confused by the fact that they were told about a settlement and the fact that they were told that this is part of the plaintiff's case, that now he has no incentive to prove. That's a very detrimental comment and reflection on what the plaintiff, why the plaintiff's in court, why the plaintiff is presenting their case. For a party to state that to the jury, and for which, of course, this was an opening, so there was nothing further, that I could do or wanted to do. I didn't really want to bring it more to the attention of the jury than it already was. But those facts go to Rule 408 and why Rule 408 and why this court has made it very clear that getting into the settlement and getting into issues of what the plaintiff claimed against other people that aren't part of the case shouldn't be gotten into unless there's a compelling reason and the court has heard those reasons and has made a balancing analysis to determine whether or not talking about the settlement is more probative than its unfair prejudicial effects. And there wasn't any real balancing by the lower court. And, in fact, in one of the lower court's footnotes, the lower court stated in its opinion that it felt that the defense had gone beyond what the court would expect to be stated in an opening and closing statement. I believe it's footnote 17. And went on to say, however, because I gave an instruction, the standard instruction about evidence or statements of attorneys is not evidence, I think that that instruction has cured the problem. So you have a situation where the lower court has already indicated it has concerns, and it felt that this was more than it expected, and he put that, and that was put right in the opinion. And we would contend.
Is it fair to read that as more than the trial judge expected, because the trial judge believed that you all had resolved this before the trial began, and everyone understood what the limitations were on comment on settlement and who would make the comments? Otherwise, how would it be more than what the trial judge expected?
Your Honor, I can't answer exactly what the trial judge meant by that. I can tell you that he made the rulings that there was going to be permitted statements about settlement, and they were challenged even during the opening, but overruled. And apparently the court felt, notwithstanding that, what he saw was beyond that.
Well, I'm trying to understand that statements about settlement may be, as in the opening, simply a comment paralleling the trial judge's comment that a party is missing because that party settled. No further comment. Is it a fair reading that the statement made in closing went beyond that and suggested what party was at fault, and that settlement was evidence that they were at fault?
I think it does, Your Honor, and I would also say that the opening went beyond that also. And he was making it very clear that Davis was at fault and that he's now going to take on the plaintiff's case against Davis because the plaintiff has no incentive to pursue that any further. So I would think it was beyond it in both, and I don't believe that the general instruction about attorneys' statements not being evidence addresses this issue.
Well, the defendant could have pursued the contribution claim by putting in evidence, then arguing about how the settled party was at fault without mentioning that settlement had any bearing on it on fault, correct?
Yes, Your Honor. And in fact did.
Well, in that vein, in referencing the argument that was made to the jury that Mr. Davis fell on his sword, was that factually accurate? Did Davis fall on his sword? Did he essentially, and if not words, then in substance, concede that he was at fault?
No, Your Honor, he did not. Not from the witness stand. No, he did not. In fact, his testimony was very short. My recollection is. But he did not admit he did anything wrong, and he certainly didn't admit that at the time of settlement, but he didn't admit it on the stand either.
What would be the effect on the incentive to settle if the net result would be people could argue that you admitted fault when there's a pending contribution claim by settling with the plaintiff? Wouldn't there be a disincentive to settle if you would be open to that kind of argument at trial?
Yes, Your Honor, there would be. And there'd be a disincentive for the plaintiff to seek settlements with any of the parties, if the rule is going to be that the defendant can come in, the non-settling defendant can come in and present this type of information to the jury.
Well, isn't the problem with the counsel statement that Davis fell on his sword that it was inaccurate, misleading, rather than the argument that you're making?
Well, Your Honor, I would say it could be both.
But it wasn't objected to.
Pardon me, Your Honor?
It was not objected to.
It was not objected to for being inaccurate, Your Honor. It was not. And again, we felt we had made objections regarding settlement well before that, and it was the law of the case, and I just felt it wasn't appropriate to keep going at an issue that the judge had already decided.
You're in your, you only have 12 seconds left. Do you want to save your 12 seconds or finish?
Well, Your Honor, I would just say this. We do have a claim against Lititz, and we've outlined it in the briefs, and we would ask the court to consider our position regarding that.
Thank you.
Your Honor, may I have a word with the court reporter concerning, or the court clerk, being as there's no discussion about the Lititz issue, about readjusting the time for this, the issue that has been discussed?
Well, it was referred to in the briefs, even though, and I'll take the comment counsel made about reasserting the arguments against Lititz in the brief and let you go on from there. I don't think talking to the clerk is going to help you at all except eat up your time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Chief Justice Steele, Justice Walsh, Justice Berger. May I please support Norman Brooks on behalf of the appellee defendant, RHIS. I would begin by answering the court's question about whether Judge Witham actually ruled on the motion, and then correct one misstatement from my friend here concerning the timing of the speaking motion in limine to exclude this testimony. I believe it was correctly stated that this issue surfaced months before the second trial, but was not raised until the day before trial, not at a pretrial conference, but at the court's routine office conference, wherein we just discussed these issues, not the pretrial stipulation. But this was raised the day before in a speaking motion with no notice to defense counsel at the time. Judge Witham did rule. He clearly expressed his expectation in denying the motion. It's my position that he denied this speaking motion in permitting defense counsel to address the fact of the settlement in statements without getting into the underlying circumstances surrounding.
Let me make sure I understand what you say. He permitted a statement about the fact of settlement or the facts of settlement?
The fact that there was a settlement, Your Honor, okay. Without going into any of the particulars about
right.
it. Again, we're not talking about evidence. We're talking about comments of counsel.
Right.
And we never took the position that there should be any evidence on this issue. It has always been the plaintiff attorney's position that there be absolutely no mention of the fact of settlement, whether it was from the court or from counsel. And it's I believe that was the impediment why there was no agreement reached. And there never was an agreement at all going into this. And the court ruled, permitting it, specifically saying, to answer the court's concern about the footnote in the opinion, about going beyond the expected limits, what the court indicated at, in ruling on this was, quote, I don't expect the attorneys to address it in consummate detail. You may discuss it, but be careful how you approach it. Simply discuss it and move on. So the issue here is whether the comments that have been cited in the record to discuss the fact of settlement in consummate detail. And it's our position that they do not.
Well, could you explain why it is that you felt that it was relevant to tell the jury at any level, whether it's in great detail or no detail, that there was a settlement with respect to another party when the claim against your client was an independent, in a lot of respects, unrelated claim?
Yes, Your Honor. This case was a little unusual in that this litigation was filed in 2002. It went to trial once and resulted in a hung jury, and then was went to trial again a year and a half later. This is a very unusual situation in that after the first trial, the plaintiff attorney was sought leave and was permitted to secure another expert, and he called another expert, liability expert, against my client. In the first trial, he actually called defendant Davis to the stand. And my cross-examination of Mr. Davis in the second trial was essentially a recap of plaintiff attorney's cross-examination in the first trial.
Okay. Try focusing on what my question is. My question is, given the nature of the claim against your client, why was there any need to have any reference to the existence of a settlement, let alone anything more than that?
Well, because it would seem unusual for the jury, I would think, to hear questions, and what I anticipated being, as Mr. Davis indicated earlier, that he wasn't going to be at trial through counsel, that I would be reading a transcript where a plaintiff attorney was asking these questions and getting the responses that he wanted. And the alignment of the parties, I think, would have been unclear concerning why is it that I am building a case and essentially proving that Mr. Davis was liable for these damages as opposed to the inspector, RHIS.
But didn't you have a cross-claim against Mr. Davis as part of this trial?
Yes, Your Honor.
So if I'm sitting there as a juror and I'm being told, okay, the plaintiff had a home inspection done, plaintiff alleges it was done imperfectly, improperly, and that's why plaintiff has a claim against your client, and the home inspector, inspection company, believes that the fault lies with the homeowner, and therefore is making a cross claim against the homeowner, so you'll hear about that too. Why does there have to be any discussion of a settlement?
Well, I think the plaintiff attorney brought this issue upon itself in his opening statements. In his opening statements, he is the one that initially said the plaintiff had claims against defendant Davis. And then when he says that they're no longer before the court, it sounds as if those claims were essentially abandoned, or those cases or those claims were dismissed as a matter of law.
So your position is that the plaintiff opened the door to a discussion of the settlement by saying in its opening that it had claims against Davis? I thought the court had already ruled on your motion or had denied plaintiff's motion to exclude all of that, right?
The court had denied the motion to exclude all references to the settlement. Yes, sir.
So having done that, now plaintiff in his opening knows that it's going to come in, right, because he lost his motion. So plaintiff makes reference in his opening statement to the fact that there were other parties and that there was a settlement or whatever. But how can you use that as your justification for bringing in the settlement? Forget what plaintiff said in his opening. If plaintiff had said nothing in his opening, which is what plaintiff would have done if he had won his claim or she had won the claim, the motion. So now we have a case, hypothetically, where plaintiff makes an opening statement about how the home inspection company didn't do its job. Now tell me why it is that the home inspection company had to let the jury know about a former claim against Davis and that it had settled in order for them to understand the case.
Well, in order for them to understand the alignment of the parties, Your Honor, as I thought I indicated earlier, we had a case where this whole thing has been tried before. We have experts coming back. Folks are going to be impeached with questions and answers by other attorneys. And why would I be impeaching a witness with a transcript with where plaintiff attorneys asking all of these questions? It was my intent as of opening statements not to call Mr. Davis. I didn't think I was required to call Mr. Davis, being as he was a party to the case. He had given sworn testimony in a previous trial. I thought I would be entitled to a read-in of his testimony only. And it was very clear that plaintiff attorney objected to that read-in, required me to issue a subpoena, and to bring him in live to ask the very same questions. So in my thinking, I would be confused if I were on the jury why it is that someone is being read a transcript where the plaintiff attorney is essentially developing all of the facts against Mr. Davis. You know, at that point of our opening statement, we do not know. I did not certainly expect I was going to be required to bring a party, Mr. Davis, and put him on live on the stand. If I could speak to the the suggestion about the falling on the sword, that I think one need not be a Bible scholar to go back to the book of 1 Chronicles and 1 Samuel, where it said that Saul wanted to his armor-bearer to take his life, and he refused to do it. He fell on the sword, and then being as seeing that, then the armor-bearer then fell on the sword. One need not be a professional soldier. One not need to be a Bible scholar. All one needs to do is to read the daily newspaper and to hear that this phrase does not mean that someone committed suicide. It means that someone has essentially accepted responsibility. That is exactly what Mr. Davis did when we did bring him and put him on the stand live at trial.
So you believe that the policy behind encouraging settlement is not vitiated by telling a jury at trial after a party has settled that they have admitted blame by settling?
Oh, I would agree with that statement 100%.
Well, then what does fall on your sword mean in the context of the jury hearing it without the benefit of Chronicles and Samuel? What do you think they took by that other than an admission of fault?
He came in and he testified live before this jury, and we have dedicated several pages in our brief to exactly what his testimony was concerning his breach of the contract, his deceit of this particular homeowner, all of the affirmative steps that he did in hiding any problems, and his failure to disclose on the seller's disclosure form.
Okay. Your time's up. Thank you. If he wishes it, that's fine with us.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You want to keep the other five?
I do.
Okay.
Your Honor, the facts in this particular case, and I'm not sure that it's appropriate for the plaintiff attorney to raise at the trial court his impression. Somehow, he got an impression that the prior jury ended in a hung jury 11-1 against my client and 12-0 against Mr. Davis.
Well, I'm confused. I thought that that Mr. Fletcher, in response to my question, said that the argument that was made to the jury, namely that Mr. Davis fell on his sword, was essentially false. That he didn't fall on his sword; he denied liability. You're claiming, however, that he did. Essentially did concede liability, or at least conceded the facts that made a liability determination inevitable. Is that right?
I would sum it up by saying he fell on the sword, Your Honor. He was very contrite when he came. He took the stand. We have outlined the substance of his testimony in several pages of our answering brief. Essentially, he admitted that he knew there was a problem. He tried to get a service contract shortly before the sale.
If the comment at closing had been limited to the context of what Mr. Davis actually said about the facts of the case that suggested the jury should infer that he was admitting fault, that would be one thing. But what is the significance of this language taken from the transcript? He essentially came in and fell on the sword. I mean, he's a nice fellow. He has settled out. He doesn't have a worry now in this case. He's not in jeopardy. He essentially fell on the sword. That context doesn't relate to what he admitted factually during his testimony about the events that would give rise to liability. That's telling the jury that the fact that he settled means he's admitted liability. Now, is that consistent with our case law, and is that consistent with public policy to encourage or incentivize settlements?
Well, assuming for purposes of this question that it's exactly as the court stated, then the court would go on to the next prong.
You want to go right to the transcript?
Of the test.
You assuming I'm reading it incorrectly?
No, Your Honor. I'm sure the court doesn't have the complete transcript there, but we've outlined in the brief what the testimony was. And the testimony was, I mean, the plaintiff has raised, right, wrong, or indifferent, he has raised that in the first trial, the jury found against Mr. Davis 12-0 on the issue of liability. And in this trial, somehow the fact where I'm arguing the empty chair, I've called this gentleman to the stand, I have force-fed him Mr. Fletcher's cross-examination in the first trial, and here you're going to expect that there's going to be something different, some different result when he's not there. He's a party. He's not there. He's not represented by counsel. His interests have not been represented at all, that there would be any difference to suggest that this another 12-0 that a verdict was not likely here on based on his own testimony.
Why was the comment made that he has settled out and the inference clearly preceded by and followed by the comment that he fell on his sword? Why was the comment made that he had settled and that is in effect evidence that he had admitted liability? That can't be read any other way. Regardless of what the facts were about liability concerning Mr. Davis, regardless of what he testified to, the problem here is the lack of parameters to the ability to talk about settlement and the reason for the jury to understand the significance of settlement. Doesn't this language suggest the significance of settlement is an admission of liability?
Well, I certainly didn't intend it that way, Your Honor. There was no evidence. There was no evidence before the jury on any settlement.
Well, why did you say, in the context of he fell on his sword, quote, he has settled out?
Well, because what's in back of my mind there at that point is the release. And the release is he has no reason to lie. He can be completely candid. He can fall on the sword. He has no liability. He has no incentive to deceive. Why should he not just come and testify truthfully, uninhibited, before this jury? And that's what he did the second time.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good afternoon. May it please the Court. I feel somewhat awkward into presenting an argument since the plaintiff did not have an opportunity to present one. And the plaintiff is willing to rely upon the brief. I am also willing to do that. Unless the Court has any questions, I would be glad to answer.
I have one question. Wasn't there an issue of fact as to what actually caused the mold?
No. And I think that's a disingenuous argument on the part of the plaintiff. The plaintiff had identified two experts who were going to talk about liability, Blum and Peter. Identified Mr. Muntz also to talk about the mold damage. Those experts were plaintiffs. The plaintiff's case against Lidditz was based on those experts and those experts only. What plaintiff is trying to say is, well, there was another expert in this case, and that was RHIS's expert. But that expert was not part of the plaintiff's case. The plaintiff never called that witness, never identified it as being his witness. So the Court is looking at the plaintiff's case against Lidditz, and there's undisputed as to how that what the damage was caused by. They both said that the underground water was pumped through the house by the way this thing was set up, way the heater was set up. The air went down and forced it out. RHIS had an expert who disputed that there was even any damage, and he said in his report, and the entire quote was somewhat missing, and this is why I think no one paid much attention to that quote. He said, while it is true that Mrs. Atwell may have suffered high humidity in the house, its source cannot be confirmed at this time. Now, he inspected it years later after the changes had been made. Further investigation is required. That's all he is saying is, I don't know the cause of the moisture. But the plaintiff's expert said they did. Now, when you have two witnesses saying this is the cause and one saying I don't know the cause, I submit that's not an issue of fact under any circumstances. But it wouldn't have been relevant anyway with regard to the plaintiff's case against Lidditz because he wasn't called as a witness in the case against Lidditz.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.